The following audio program is suitable for all ages. It's July 8th, 2007, and you're tuned in to the RetroBits Podcast. Hi, I'm your host, Earl Evans, and this is the show where we talk about computing like we did it back in the day. That's right. Here we're all about old-school computing and modern-day fun. If it's got 8 bits, paper tape, punch cards, CPM, cartridge slots, BASIC and ROM, or if it's just plain old, then you've found the right podcast. This is show number 92, and today's topic, A Close Encounter, the CompuColor 2. Information about the RetroBits podcast can be found at our podcast hosting site. That URL is RetroBits, RetroBits.libsyn.com. If you'd like to send email, the email address here is RetroBits@gmail.com. And if you'd like to join in on our online interactive discussion forum, you can find a link for that in the show notes at the RetroBits.libsyn.com site. Well, hey there, everybody. I got to tell you, summer has arrived with a vengeance here in the Pacific Northwest. It's been quite hot. I mean, like, you know, 90s kind of stuff. And sunny with blue skies. I mean, it's beautiful. It's nice for a while to be out in it. Then you duck into the air conditioning because, woo-hoo-hoo. Work continues to be hectic but fun. After quite a few years of doing computing work that was more abstract and architectural, I've moved into a position that gives me the chance to roll up my sleeves, and I'm having a good time. I like to keep a balance, and I feel fortunate to have some flexibility in my workplace. So, cool stuff, but busy, busy, busy. Now, if I could just talk them into free soda and pizza. those dot-com days are really gone, aren't they? On the email and forum section, I'm going to skip this week. It's a very light week. Probably folks are running around on vacation, but be sure to tune in next week for that. Now, on the news and links section, before I forget, one or two people did email me on this. I'm kind of collecting up a few of them if I can, from last week's podcast. If you've got stories about user groups that you've been involved with, you know, past or present, shoot them to me. I'd be happy to talk about them on the podcast. I think users groups are a great thing. It's, you know, a fun part of our computing legacy. And if you've got interesting stories, I'd love to hear about it. But on to the news and links. Gamma Sutra, a noted computer game-oriented site. And it could be Gamma Sutra. Anybody know how to pronounce it? Anyway, they've got an article titled The History of Zork. I'll have a link for this up in the show notes. As the introduction to this article describes, it's not so much a history of the technical development of Zork as it is an exploration of the influence of some of these early text-based interactive fiction games. Of course, the article is primarily concerned with Zork, and how things have actually evolved since the beginnings. There are quotes from some of the people involved in Zork's history, and the article does provide some insight on where the game came from and a glimpse into the history of Infocom, the makers of Zork. It's 6 pages, so it's a quick read, and it's quite interesting. If you've got time, give it a read. Again, a link up in the show notes. There will also be a bonus link on another history of Zork, written by Tim Anderson and Stu Galley. So be sure to check that out. Now, in related news, and by the way, thanks to A2Central.com for this tip. Jason Scott, the creator of the BBS documentary, is creating another documentary, this one on text-based adventure games, text-based interactive fiction. It sounds as though this may be ready for purchase as soon as early 2008. It's going to be a 2-DVD set. Check the website for more details. A link, of course, will be up in the show notes. I can tell you, having seen the BBS documentary, I'm greatly looking forward to Jason Scott's next masterpiece. Should be cool. And the website for that, by the way, is www.getlamp.com. You know, like those text-based adventures, GitLamp, Smack Enemy, you know, those kind of commands. That's good. Now, today's topic, A Close Encounter, the CompuColor 2. I'll tell you that today's show is going to be a little bit on the short side. I know some of you like the longer shows for things like commuting or walking the dog, that kind of thing. Do hang in there, because I've got some topics coming up in the next few weeks that are really going to stretch the limits, I think, of a 30-minute podcast. So, but this week will be a little bit on the short side, just for one reason. There's not a ton of information on the computer that I'm covering, and I think as I describe it, you'll begin to understand why that is. When I was in high school, I had a buddy who was very much into computers, just like me. However, he had some resources at his disposal that I didn't have. Both his father and his brother worked for IBM. So, as you can imagine, he had exposure to quite a few technologies. One day, he brought a computer to school for some of the rest of us to have a look at, which was really cool of him to do in the first place. I appreciated it. The computer was called a CompuColor 2. That's all one word, CompuColor. It was a computer, the brains of which were actually built into what looked like the chassis of a TV set. Basically, it looked like a TV with a disk drive and an attached keyboard. It was fascinating. One of the things that really impressed me was the crispness of the graphics and color text. I had, of course, seen color. I mean, the Apple II was the first microcomputer I'd ever laid hands on. That obviously had color, and we took advantage of it in our junior high classroom. We used one of those big screen, well, for the time that is, TVs. Remember those that rolled into the class on a metal cart and you could use them to watch, you know, fascinating stuff like seasonal ant migrations? But we used it for the Apple, and so color was something I was used to. But this was more high res, this CompuColor. The computer and the TV box thing was pretty intriguing. Now, there are some computer systems that I've only been able to play around with briefly, like two ships passing in the night. That's one of the reasons why I titled this podcast episode A Close Encounter. It is just a close and brief encounter. Some of the other systems that I've had this experience with include the Apple III and the Cyber mainframe at my college, and also the Atari ST. A friend of mine owned more than one Atari ST, but I just didn't play with them very much over at his house. And also, among these is the CompuColor 2. I was only able to goof around with that computer, hands-on keyboard, for a few minutes of one day. Very brief. But it made an impression on me. So I'll talk about what I've been able to dig up in the podcast, which, incidentally, there's only a few online resources. If someone has one of these or has more information about it, I'd love to hear about it. Feel free to email me, retrobits@gmail.com. The CompuColor 2 Model 8051 was introduced in 1977 by Intelligent Systems Corp, or ISC. ISC sold a variety of terminals and computer systems. They even had a color inkjet printer and some other interesting stuff. At some point, CompuColor Corporation became a spinoff. But I don't have the precise chronology. I don't know exactly when that happened. The 8051 was a sequel to an earlier model that they made called the CompuColor 8001. That one had a bigger screen, had some other attributes. You can get information about that one online. The CompuColor 2 used an Intel 8080A as its CPU, and online accounts indicate that this ran somewhere between 2 and 2.8 megahertz. The unit was available with 16, 32, or 48K of RAM. And this depended on how big your pocketbook was. The floppy that it had 52K of data per disk, which doesn't sound like a whole lot. But that didn't matter because some of the time the floppy drive would forget the information that you put on it, but that's a story that I'll get to in a bit. BASIC was available in ROM, CompuColor BASIC, and apparently, according to information I dug up for you on the internets, this was a ripped-off version of Microsoft BASIC, albeit with additional functionality included to make use of the computer's unique color capabilities. Interesting. The keyboard on this thing was really a work of art. It had keys of various colors representing the different functions that the keys were there for. I didn't get to type on it much, but I liked looking at it. It's just pretty. To this day, in fact, I have a soft spot for color-coded keyboards. The Epson PX8, my little portable retro companion, has different colored keys. It has black, gray, mustard, and red keys, and I love it. The CompuColor 2, pictured on oldcomputers.com, and I will have that link for you, is practically a rainbow. It's almost a bit busy, but very eye-catching and pretty darn unique. So here's some interesting notes of trivia that I was able to dig up on the CompuColor 2. The machine really has some interesting idiosyncrasies in both the hardware and its history. For one thing, the hardware on the CompuColor 2 was susceptible to some software-generated pranks, some of which were pretty serious. You could, for instance, apparently cause the machine to generate smoke with a simple basic program. Now, my guess is, and I think some other people were thinking the same thing from what I read, what you were doing was fooling around with the integrated video controller. I think I read that was from Intel, the one that they had in there. Probably changing scan rates and such on a custom video controller chip. And that's a common way to zap the CRT that's attached to a system. It was certainly possible to do that on an Epson QX10, one of the computers I worked with in my career, more than just a brief encounter. And it's reported that there was a killer poke for one of the Commodore PET models, although there's some controversy over whether such a poke really exists, whether it would really kill a PET. But again, you know, these are systems with an integrated CRT. They've got a programmable video controller chip, and you just get that thing banging the CRT at higher capabilities than what it has, and poof. Now, aside from making your CompuColor release its magical smoke, you could also make the machine ditch the contents of its RAM. All you had to do was mess around with a couple of hardware registers. However, unless I'm reading it wrong, that sounds like a temporary setback, right? So you scramble your RAM, well, so what? You turn off and reboot. Not quite as serious as a fried system. There is more than one report, like I mentioned a couple minutes ago, that the BASIC on the CompuColor 2, like I said, called CompuColor BASIC, really was lifted and an enhanced version of Microsoft's product. And it's also rumored that Microsoft struck a deal with the company at some point. I don't know what the terms were. I couldn't find that, but whatever the terms, they were still allowed to continue to use their BASIC dialect, so they must have come to some agreement. There were a variety of keyboard choices for this system. The one pictured on the Computer Closet website and on the oldcomputers.com site is the deluxe model with many, many keys, full spread keyboard. And I don't think that was the one that I used way back when I saw the CompuColor 2. I remember the keyboard being smaller than the one that's pictured, so it must have been one of the less deluxe models. But there were still, and I remember this well, a variety of colors. So presumably the various models had these different color encodings. But, man, take a look at that keyboard that I'll have on the picture up in the show notes, and it's kind of amazing. It's huge. Although the CompuColor 2 shipped with a disk drive, a pre-release design of the machine reportedly used an 8-track tape as storage. That's interesting in and of itself. You could have computer data and 70s rock all in the same media. Now, don't make fun, though, because I had an 8-track tape in my car, okay? So, you know, don't want to hear any old jokes. It's a retro computing podcast, all right? Not touchy. The 8051, indeed, though, did ship with a disk drive. But the logic inside still thought it was a tape drive. And this led to some funny results, like the system defragmenting all the disk contents back to the beginning of the disk whenever you deleted a file, probably doing some maintenance activities that you would expect to see in a tape system, but not on a disk drive. Oh, well. The CompuColor 2 had a rudimentary disk operating system, but it didn't allow you to format your own floppy disks. This meant that if you wanted to use your floppy drive, you had to buy pre-formatted disks from the company. Of course, as anyone who knows technical people must realize, this was merely a speed bump. Eventually, of course, disk formatting programs came out that let people format their own floppies. I remember floppy disks back then were like super expensive. You remember that? I mean, I'm thinking $30, $40, $50 a box, depending on what kind you were talking about. Dyson made some of the nicest floppy disks, as I'm recalling it, some of the most deluxe. But man, those things were incredible. And that, so you can imagine all this, and now you've actually got to buy these at full list pop from the manufacturer. apparently closer to the end of the machine's life, ISC finally marketed a disk formatting program of their own. Wow. It would just take amazing gall to intentionally leave out a format command, insisting instead that the users buy pre-formatted full list price floppy disks. I'm just shaking my head. It's like, I don't know, what's an analogy? It's like expecting a consumer purchasing online music to be content with it being digitally smothered so it only plays, say, on one type of player. You know? Ridiculous, right? Hey, wait a minute. All right, back on topic. The floppy drive was right next to the power supply in the system. It was also right next to the CRT. Now, on other computer systems that I've used, you didn't want a floppy disk drive near either one of those things. And apparently this did cause heartache. One person in a discussion forum that I saw reported, you didn't want to have your floppy disk inside the machine when you turned it on because the monitor degaussing, you know, that thing that it does, it would basically zap your floppy. Also, on some of the early models, if the speed drifted enough, there was a little potentiometer inside the machine. You could adjust the speed, but it drifted over time, and so your floppies would eventually become unreadable. Interesting reliability problems. Kind of a bummer, you know, I mean, because I didn't know that stuff when I was first looking at the computer. Loses a little bit of the luster, but hey, these were early systems, right? 1977, they all had problems. This 64-character screen mode is interesting. You could either do 40 or 64 characters. There just must be something about 64. Maybe it's a power of two? I don't know. The TRS-80 Model 1 and 3, if I remember right, oh, you TRS-80 people will clobber me if I get this wrong, but as I recall, they had a 64-column display as well, and you didn't get to 80 columns until you got to the Model 4. It just seems like 40 or 80 would be the way to go. But perhaps the video tube in the CompuColor 2 didn't have enough bandwidth for 80 columns. And that could have been the case with the integrated monitor with the TRS-80 Model 1 and 3 as well. And 64 is a decent compromise. Certainly, you could do word processing and other interesting things with 64 columns. It's enough. Although, I'm not sure that there was a word processor for the CompuColor 2, but if there would have been, certainly it could have been usable. Now, I'm not sure how long the CompuColor 2 lasted as a product, but the predecessor model, the 8001 that I talked about, which is confusingly alternately called a terminal and a computer system, depending on what site you're reading. But that system was remarkably not discontinued until 1993. Wow, that was a long run. Could be that it was just, you know, this specialty terminal kind of thing, and it had those uses, and so they kept it alive as long as they could. Now, regarding modern-day fun, something I always try and cover, the best you can do, unless I'm mistaken, and do let me know if I am, is read about the CompuColor 2, because they are essentially impossible to find. I mean, some people have them. There's these online museums, and there are real units out there. One of the persons in the forums that I read said they've got a couple in their basement. But I don't think I've ever seen one on eBay. And no emulator exists that I've been able to locate. Someone guessed that only 4,000 of these machines were made. If so, if that's true, that would account for the rarity. I'm lucky enough to have seen one, and at one point in my lifetime to have laid my hands on one and cranked out a little color basic code. It was fun. This machine foreshadowed some of the future for me, a time when high-res color would be the norm. My first PC compatible, even. This was 1985, a compact Espro system. That didn't even have a color monitor. And a lot of circles, especially in aerospace where I worked, color was considered a luxury item. Color was just for playing games or something like that. I had to wait until much later when I graduated to, my first 286 PC clone. Then I was really styling, and finally I had a color monitor and a color card. I was able to relive the color with lots of characters and lots of dots like I was able to see a few years before on the CompuColor 2. But still, the keyboard was bland. They're even bland today. I use a Creative Fatality keyboard. It's a nice little thin jobby. It illuminates with a nice blue glow. And it has a very short keystroke motion, so I can type super fast, clickety, clickety. But it's still monochrome. When will we learn? Now, I've got links in the show notes for the old-computers.com site, some screenshots on computercloset.org, and a history on the companies that included CompuColor Corporation, although this history focuses more on the computer terminals that this company made. And all of those will be up at retrobits.libsyn.com. Speaking of which, that's it for this week, and retrobits.libsyn.com is where you can go to look at the show notes, including these links that I have alluded to. If you'd like to send email, that address is retrobits@gmail.com. And if you'd like to join us over on the forum, a link for that will be up in the show notes at retrobits.libsyn.com. I hope you all have a fantastic week. I will check in with you again in about 7 days. And until then, take care. Bye-bye.